Through January and the beginning of February, we just talked our way through a sequence of topics that are kind of the prereqs or the foundations in Buddhism. A series of topics that in a way prepare the heart for deeper practice, for liberation practice. And this is a list that includes the practice of giving, or dana, the practice of ethics, or sila, the practice of understanding that wholesome or good actions lead to good future births. This is the teaching on heavens. Basically, if you act really ethically, but you don't get liberated, you can be reborn in a heaven realm. And then the fourth and fifth in the list are the teaching on the dangers of sensual pleasures, which is basically that you get too attached to them and then do harmful things as a result, and the benefits of renunciation, which is that recognizing that sensual pleasures come and go, can't be relied on for happiness, it's better to let go, so let go. And that leads to the rest of the path. So the Buddha would give these five topics that in a certain way are a bit directional, right? They all in a certain way have to do with letting go. They start off by saying, you know, don't cling to material wealth. And in many of the times in the discourses that he gives this talk, he gives it to wealthy people. He says, you know, first, be really generous. Be a patron of the ascetics, of religious practitioners. Support the Sangha, the monastics. But also, support your entire community. And there's a beautiful text at one point where the Buddha tells a story of a nation where there was a lot of crime and chaos happening, and the king didn't know how to bring order back to the country, and the king asks his minister, who is very wise, and they get a teaching essentially on how to be an enlightened ruler. And the teaching is this, you know, find out what everyone needs to do their profession, so, and then give it to them. So the farmers need, you know, land and seeds and tools, supply that for them. And the business people need capital and loans and you know, raw materials, supply that to them. And it kind of goes through all the social classes, and from the working classes up to business people, essentially, and says, you know, make sure that they have what they need to do their livelihood. And when they do their livelihood, they will have enough to support themselves, and there won't be crime. And it's sort of, you know, it's a little sort of mythically too easy. But it recognizes, for instance, that crime and social disruption is not, you know, because people are bad. That it's because people are hungry, you know, and don't have enough, in a very basic way, poverty, and so hi, people from Bernie Sanders' campaign texting me, yes, socialism, and it's very difficult in a certain way because that whole thing, in a sense, depends on the morality of the rich, like. People with wealth need to be persuaded in a certain way to give it away. So this is the first teaching, dana. It's like, give away wealth. Support your community, support people, support religious practitioners. The second one is ethical action itself. Don't hurt anyone as best you can. The third is that if you do this, you can be assured of a good result, going to heaven, going to beneficial places in this life, but also after you die. The caveat for heavens, of course, is that they're temporary. And you could think of them almost as, you know, fortunate phases in your life, or even fortunate mind states. You know? So let's say you become, you know, materially comfortable doing something, and you get to become a philanthropist and give money away, and you're safe enough in a certain way that you can behave ethically, and then we could talk about the mysterious flow between, like, how do you make money ethically at all in this world now? But in the Buddhist time, it was assumed that that was possible, that you could make money in a way without hurting others, and that you could then end up in a mind state or a realm that was comfortable and easeful for a while. And eventually that ends. The money runs out, the mind state runs out. The birth in the heaven realm, if you think about it literally, runs out. And then you return to the cycle. Heaven is not liberation, but it's a beneficial place to be for a while. And then the teaching turns toward liberation. And it says, okay, now that you're established in a certain way in moral goodness and in generosity and in the basic understanding, in a way, of how energy works in the universe, that, like, good action leads to good results, harmful action leads to painful results. That's just true. That's the underlying, like, theorem behind the entire system. If you don't believe that, none of the rest makes sense. And if you don't believe that, you're what the early Buddhist system would be called a nihilist, one who doesn't believe in the effects of actions. So it says, okay, now that you're established in generosity and ethics and the right view that actions lead to appropriate results, to matching results, then you can start to be given the core liberation teaching. And that is encapsulated in a way in those last two topics, the dangers and sensual pleasures and renunciation. When the Buddha would give this set of topics, the discourses say, you know, he gave a graduated teaching on these five things, and then when the listener's mind was well prepared, malleable, available, ready for the deeper teachings, then he gave to them the teaching special to the Buddhas, which is the Four Noble Truths, the truth of the dissatisfaction inherent in sensory life, that you never really get what you want in a 100% kind of way. And when you get even a bit of it, you lose it, inevitably, at some point. And then all this stuff happens that you didn't want, and you can't prevent that. And that's fundamental to being here. This is called dukkha. This is the painful aspect of life that is unavoidable, absolutely unavoidable, whether for the rich or the protected in whatever way, even for those in heaven realms, dukkha, the painful aspect is unavoidable. Yeah? If you're really in a heaven realm, we could think about folks who are, like, deeply privileged here and now, you know, humans that have lives of great ease and beauty, perhaps. You know, they're subject to old age, sickness, and death like everyone else. And, you know, the Buddha says in many of the texts, he says, you know, wealth is great because you get to give it away and be a great supporter of people. But, of course, if you have wealth, you have to protect it from bandits and, you know, kings who tax too much and, it says, ungrateful heirs. You know, all the people that want to take your wealth. And he says, you got to protect it from them. You know, that's suffering. And of course, you might lose it at any moment. At one point, a long time ago, I made my living teaching piano lessons. I had a student in San Francisco who was a banker, worked at Bear Stearns, if you remember that bank. It doesn't exist anymore. Before the big crash of 08. And I knew it happened because Bear Stearns was sort of was the tipping point of the crash. This sort of terrible thing happened and all the credit drained away and this huge investment bank basically crumbled into worthlessness overnight. And my piano student was a vice president, was one of many vice presidents of that bank. And I called him up. We were gonna have a piano lesson on that like Wednesday or something that had happened. Or it happened on Tuesday or something like that. And I wrote him an email or a text or whatever we did back then. dark ages 10 years ago. And I said, you know, hey man, I suspect you might be having a difficult day. Like, do you still want to have a panel? And he was like, yeah, come on over. And so I went over and I said, how are you doing? And he said, I lost $2.5 million in 1 hour last night. And I was like, whoa, right? That's substantial. And I was like, you've got a cushion, right? And he said, well, yeah. And I was like, so you actually had enough that you could lose $2.5 million in a night and be here, you know, kind of like complaining about it, but still trucking. I was like, I should raise my rates, dude. And he's like, yeah, but not today. You know, wealth is going to be lost. You know, life is going to be lost. And so the sequence, right? Get generous, get ethical, get a little wise, and then recognize the danger in sensual pleasures, in addiction or just grasping at all. And then the benefits of letting go, renunciation. That leads right into the Four Noble Truths that says, you know, this thing is unsatisfying, ultimately. You know, satisfaction comes and goes, but you can't rely on it. And the Second Noble Truth says the cause of that is clinging. And this is the hinge of the whole thing. The cause of suffering or pain or that dissatisfaction, and this is like a kind of existential, sort of deep soul dissatisfaction, you know, is clinging. Clinging to what? Right? Clinging to image. So clinging to seeing sights that you like, you know, like your sweetheart is pretty right now, you know, but he's going to age eventually, right? You know, she's going to change shape as we all do, right? How attached are you to the beauty of the sight you see? When I think about clinging to image, especially kind of sensual attractiveness, think about how microscopic a difference it is between, let's say, like the face of someone you're attracted to and the face of someone you're not. That they could be like really very, very similar. Like, we're not that different from each other. But then like somebody in their particular exactness makes your synapses go bing, and somebody like nearly identical to them, nothing. Right? What's up with that? What's up with that? What a particular suffering, especially if you don't have contact with the one who makes your synapses go zing and you're running around the world looking for them. I know you're not doing that, except that you might be, because we all do a little bit of that. Not all, but many. Good luck. It's great, right? You find that person, you're like, oh my God, I found my person, like, pow. And then, like, you know, yeah, but are you their person? And for how long? And what conditions, what circumstances are necessary to maintain that? You know? And even if, like, everything works out, you know, bang, zoom, storybook, you know, go ahead, marry them and see what happens. You know? And we still, we're still like, yeah, no, I'm not that shallow. Like, I'm totally going to get old and be in love with my person. Like, it's, you might. And then watch them die. At one point, my sweetheart, my wife, and I, we had the conversation that was like, would it be better for you to die first or me? Like, would you rather see me die or leave me behind? And I was like, oh. Because really, you know, the end of the whole thing is if we succeed beautifully at having a long, beautiful marriage, may it be so, one of us watches the other die. You know, or in some way loses the other. Like, no, we're both going to die at exactly the same moment. And it's like, great, so then our son is going to watch it. Like, that's terrible, that's awful. Like there's no good ending. There's a beautiful teacher right now, Stephen Jenkinson. I implore you to go and find him and listen to him. He's a Canadian teacher teaching on dying and elderhood right now. And he worked in kind of hospice chaplaincy and what he calls the death trade for many years, and now is a sort of grumpy poetic prophet, preaching in the Canadian wilderness. He's a brilliant, brilliant thinker. Because he's done all this death work, people ask him, they're like, well, what do you want your death to be like? People always ask this one here. And he says, oh, you know, everyone says the same thing. They want it to be peaceful and nicely ritual with all of the bright people around and all that. He said, what that is really a wish for it not to happen. That is a wish for it to be as kind of invisible or not really happening as possible. All the people that say, I want to just kind of go quietly in my sleep, you know, all of that in a certain way is a wish to not engage with the reality of the thing. And he's like, may I die messy and loud? Because that's actually what is happening. You know, let's be honest about what this thing is. And he talks so beautifully about what it is to grieve and what it is to be in the presence of death and what it is to reckon with the disruption of indigenous life and with the disruption of place and the loss of true elders and people who can teach you how to move and how to die in this world. Beautiful, beautiful teacher, Stephen Jenkinson. So the second noble truth says, you know, this is going to happen. Clinging is the thing that's really making it hurt, makes it sting. And so renunciation, this fifth of these kind of foundational topics, is the seed of how to deal with this. And in a certain way, it comes down to this, right? Like, stop clinging. And we can really just say, like, let go. Let go. So, you know, what does that mean, you know? It's like, oh, let go of image. Like, don't expect, like, stop, if I can, like, subconsciously or trying to construct my life so that I only see pretty things, right? Including my own body, right? It's like, oh no, another aging spot. It's like, no, that's clinging. You know, clinging to youth, clinging to strength, clinging to beauty, clinging to non-pain. We cling to feeling or affect, clinging to the pleasurable, of course, clinging to the absence of the painful. Good luck, right? It's out of our hands. You can set up the best conditions possible and you still get less pleasure than you want and more pain than you wanted. We cling to our perceptions of things, our meanings around things. We cling to the very fact of being awake at all. We cling to life. In a parallel tradition, in the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, the deepest of the wrong views or the mistaken perceptions of abhinivesha, clinging to life. And the sutra says, clinging to life is instinctive even for the wise. Huh. Even for the wise. Yeah. One of the teachers also that I'm loving right now is a German-born, Sri Lankan-ordained Theravada Buddhist monk named Anālio. He's living in Massachusetts right now. He's been an extremely prolific scholar and author. His writing is dry but extremely precise. If you want to really get the heart of the early Buddhist tradition as it's being reconstructed, he's absolutely one to go to. And I guess this is partly a teaching on death tonight, but one of his core practices that he's emphasized and that he teaches beautifully, and we'll do a little bit of it next month, is the practice of the recollection of death, the death contemplations, which is really a progressive visualization of several stages of a corpse in decay, accompanied by the reflection that this body too will undergo this process inevitably. And so, you know, letting go of clinging even to this life. And that all seems like, well, what's left then if you don't hold on to anything? You know, does that mean don't love? Does it mean don't be attached to goodness or justice? And it doesn't mean that. In a very specific way, you know, it means don't cling. Don't cling to things being the way you want, basically. So then renunciation is the teaching that says, let go. Figure out where your heart is constricting. Around what is it constricting? And see that thing, whatever it is, with wisdom. My heart is constricting around, finding or maintaining or, solidifying or getting better with or whatever, like my true love. That's great, actually. It's beautiful, right? Family is beautiful. Love is beautiful. It's actually totally possible to be wildly in love and to really commit to relationship, but not to cling. Because clinging isn't to the thing. It's like, oh, I'm clinging to my wife. I married her. I totally cling to her. But what it is not clinging to things being like a certain way. It would be like saying, like, oh, hey, sweetie, don't change. Don't change that part, right? Continue to be, a 25-year-old hippie who's super into, Nine Inch Nails. Right? So good. So gone. Right? That's gone. It's really more Fugazi for my girl. We'd have these, like, music appreciation nights. Because we're a slightly different generations. I'm 9 years older than she is. We have really different cultures, so we have whole different musical backgrounds. So we would have one night where she was like, listen, just sit down. I'm gonna give you a download, DC Hardcore. Here it is. And she played me all these bands. And I'm like, oh my God. And she's just having like, wow, this is the music. And I'm like, I love you so much. Wow, Fugazi, amazing. And then a whole different night, I'm like, okay, we're really going to do it. This is, what did we do for me at one point? I was like, this is the 15th century Flemish school of counterpoint, and I played Ockeghem and Josquin and Orlando de Lassus, and I was like, listen to how the voices weave, and she was like, oh dude, like that's gorgeous, you guys are tripping, and I was like, yeah, totally, so. But like, where is all that? Where are those kids? Right? Where'd they go? They're gone. It's not her anymore. It's not me anymore. That's not me. To cling would be to hold on to the idea feeling that I could have that in perpetuity, that we could be young lovers forever. We're not that. Now we're middle-aged, tired parents, and we process way more than we have fun. We have a 3-year-old. It's like, that's what everyone I know who has a 3-year-old is doing, hanging on by our fingernails. But even that hanging on, like, is that clinging? How could we do this thing and not cling? So the practice of letting go becomes this deep soul orientation that is something like the full richness of life is available, but only when I don't limit my field of what I'm allowing in to this tiny range of things. Oh, it's only okay if it's like this. It's like, well, that's probably not going to happen. I won't get that. And so I'm missing, in a certain way, the richness of existence by doing that. Clinging shuts us down, even if we're clinging to something good. So this becomes the heart of the teaching then. How deeply can you let go? And then, because it's not all just like let go, like thank you very much, good night. It's really like, what happens then? What happens when you let go? You know, if I take the example of the romance and the marriage again, which is a good one for this, we're not the same people for each other, for ourselves. What happens when we don't cling is that the person is actually fresh. They might be freshly annoying, yeah, or freshly beautiful in a different way, or mysterious, or like, oh, who are you now, you know? But if we cling, we can't see that. We don't get that piece, right? If we cling, we're just stuck in like, oh, why isn't it the way it was? When we don't cling, when we let go, what we're letting go of really is the past. We're letting go of how things were. Like, oh, you know, I was a young Ashtanga yogi, and I could do this kind of beautiful floaty jump back where I kind of almost hovered for a moment, and the thing I worked on every day in class, because, you know, privilege, is like landing without a thump, getting my toes to the back of the mat to kind of like lightly touch down. What a heaven realm, right? I made enough money teaching piano lessons to bankers and people, and I went to yoga every day and danced, and this was my concern, was like, oh, let me perfect this gymnastic maneuver. It's gone, right? When was the last time I did that? And the last time that I did that jump back, did I know it was the last time? Or was I just like, oh, this again? I do sort of remember the last time because I was teaching. I was teaching class, and I was like, hey, everybody, let's do jump backs. And I demonstrated it. And it was pretty good. Not too bad. A little clunky. And then I was like, oh, I haven't done that in a while. And I remember having the thought, and I might not again. But then what happens? You know, if you don't cling, that actually means that this moment's unfolding life, and all the moments to come, may you have many, are new and kind of mysterious to you. Who is this person across the bed or the kitchen table or the yoga room or sitting in your own seat? Try this sometime. Some morning when your mind feels a little fresh and you go into the bathroom and you do your cleaning up or whatever you do, take a moment and just stop at the mirror and just see yourself. Look at your face and just hang out there for 3 or 4 minutes. And not even, even a minute will do it, right? Sometimes I'll just look and I'll be like, hey. And it's like, do I even recognize myself? Like, I do, but like, who is that? And if I actually don't cling, it becomes fresh in a very interesting, strange way. So that's the core teaching. When you do that, the Four Noble Truths suggests, when you let go that deeply, or more and more deeply, more and more lets go, eventually your whole sense of self gets pretty soft. It's what it feels like, fluid. Just open, really. So I want to say a couple things more in the sort of socio-political, just to sort of tag them before we go on. This is the heart of the Buddha's teaching, and it's good, it works, it's right in so many ways for so many. And we live in a time and a place where, for instance, so many folks are poor, wounded, suffering, and who don't have enough. And in a certain way, if the process starts with material giving and ethical action, and moves toward, you know, really letting go of wanting things to be the way you want, that sounds great, and it is great, but what about those folks, I'll say those of us broadly, who might hear this teaching and say, you know, I don't have that much to let go of. I'm struggling to even, like, get the basics. What would it mean to say, like, you know, let go of having things be the way you want? If what you're doing is actually, like, you know, working, you know, the double shift to feed a family, or really trying to heal from an illness or a trauma or an attack, or, like, in so many ways, being fully engaged in the process of needing, in a certain way, to cling to things, even just getting up to a baseline of safety and comfort. I feel like in the arrival of this kind of Buddhism in the West, one of the things that we're opening into is that teachings like this, that incline toward deep renunciation and letting go, need to be accompanied by clear thinking and feeling and kindness, and not to take a teaching like this in an overly facile way. You know, like, I'm just not going to go into, let's say, a prison. I'm giving a talk later this summer to folks who work with the Buddhist Pathways Prison Project. You know, I would never go into a prison, say, you know, and say, okay, you guys, the path to liberation is just to let go, just to accept fully that, you know, life is unsatisfactory, and just relax into what is. Like, I could, and maybe somebody there would be like, oh, wow, that totally, I can do that. But my first guess would be like, oh, that's actually not appropriate. That's not the right place to start. I'm curious in some ways. I'm doing some research right now. I'm curious about the Buddha teaching this kind of teaching quite a bit to rich folks, middle-class folks, you know, like give away wealth, support the community, let go more and more deeply. He was wealthy himself to start with. And then teaching to monastics whose basic needs were taken care of. Just let go. I wrote to one of my teachers this week as I was thinking about talking about this and thinking about just the stuff that I'm writing about right now. I said, like, hey, what about the poor folks? You know, what exactly are the practices for folks who are embedded either in a, you know, trying to heal from trauma or trying to recover from poverty, which in a certain way are the same thing. And I don't have a good answer for it right now. I want to say that this teaching on deep letting go is applicable to everybody, but I also want to say something like, and this probably, in the end, the answer will be something like refuge, that in a way, a deep letting go of, materially speaking, things get being the way you want, is available even if you have a very, very difficult material life. If there's something else to hold you, there has to be some ground to that. And I think ultimately, within the faith tradition anyway, the ground will be refuge. The taking of deep refuge will uplift. And the faith and recollection practices will be what holds you. And it is not random that teachings on deep letting go fill the discourses, but it's actually teachings on devotion that fill the temples. Like, the thing that is actually being preached and practiced by the vast majority of ordinary Buddhists all over the world is not the subtle psychology of letting go deeper and deeper into, you know, the groundless space of being. That's super abstract, and, you know, American hippies love it. But the thing that most folks do actually is pray and sing and you know, ask for better fortune, like ask for good fortune, and ask for, like, how is my family going to be safer, and who's going to pay for education, and maybe we could, you know, be born in a better place next time. And that's the heartland, as it were, of Buddhist faith. And it's not separate from this. You know. The proposal formally, in a certain way, is when you're suffering so deeply that this kind of profound but abstract letting go is not the right medicine for you, the thing to do, actually, is just to pray for more ease and to build community and take care of each other in community in a very ordinary material way. You know, feed people, give medicine to people, and, you know, act ethically, honor your elders and your ancestral line, and take care of the monks and nuns, and pray to the Buddha. And remember heavens, right? That's what that teaching's in there for, I think. Remember that good action generates good result. And that the result of all this won't just be like, oh, you know, heaven realm, like maybe. That the result of this, in a certain way in the nervous system, is enough ease. Like the result of faith and really connecting to the path in a heart-centered way gives this ground of well-being, and even in material difficulty, and then based in that, the teachings on letting go and can unfold from there. So rich people give a lot of money away. Poor people don't give your money away. Uplift each other, you know, and care for the community, and yeah. And if you have the privilege to be able to let go in that kind of psychological sense, then just know that as uncomfortable as it is absolutely the heart of the practice. Thoughts and reflections here for our last little bit. As you're reflecting, a question that we could end with, or meditate on for a couple minutes, would be something like, what kind of or aspect of letting go would really be the right medicine for me right now? Am I clinging to ideas or identities? Do I cling to specific things or people or roles? Does letting go not make sense to me because I'm still trying to put together my life? And if so, what does make sense? Or even, how could the teaching on letting go support me in building a more coherent or resilient life? And if you want to take it a little more toward the edge, it would be something like, what's something that I really actually in my heart know that I would be better off letting go of, though that is hard to let go of? And just see what comes, what moves with that question. Anything you notice as you do that, or questions. What do you think?
I always have questions.
Right?
I was like thinking about like, why would these practices be kind of different based on socioeconomic status in some way, and what does that mean for the nervous system? And I was thinking about how Sharon Salzberg was talking about you know, metta being such a beautiful anecdote for fear. And then I was like, who probably experiences more fear? People high SES or people low SES? And I was like, I don't know. You know, and what would letting go be to the nervous system? Is it a releasing, and is like metta an opening? Is devotion opening? I was just trying to think of like, why? And what would that do?
I mean, what if we think of letting go as like nervous system deactivation? So like I'm engaged in, you know, my fight response in a certain way, like don't take my stuff, or you know, or like don't leave me, you know, whatever it is. And that letting go would be deactivating out of that fight or flight or freeze response into a kind of oriented present. Metta is an antidote to fear, partly simply because you can only ever experience one emotion at a time. So if you can invoke a wholesome emotion, you automatically can't hang out in the unwholesome one. And then it's kind of its opposite. Like, you know, if I think someone's going to hurt me, wishing them well, you know, kind of jams the circuits in this way. You just can't do both in a certain way. But yeah, I think about, there's a certain way that like metta essentially is the favorite practice of the, you know, low socioeconomic status folks. Like it's more helpful than, you know, insight practice. I'm not going to tell someone who's coming from poor or traumatized circumstances, you know, like, deconstruct your mind states and see how everything is empty, flickering phenomena without a self to be found, right? That's ego dystonic for someone who's still trying to assemble some clarity in this world, right? I don't think it's about, like, who has more or less fear as much as what's the right medicine for that nervous system. And so, you know, in a certain way, the privileged nervous system often tends toward freeze, right? Rather than even fight or flight, because certainly if you're comfortable enough, you might not need to be in that sort of active mode, and you may be comfortable enough that you're really resting in health, but you also might be, you know, overwhelmed, which so many are, because the stimulus is also high, and so then freeze. Poor folks perhaps, you know, are forced into the active mode more often because of actual concrete danger and threat. You know, and then freeze becomes a response to that, like, oh, pervasive threat is intolerable, so freeze happens. But letting go, in a certain way, could be not different from, you know, learn how to take your attention off of the source of the threat, which would be the core thing you're doing if you're going to come out of fight, flight, or freeze, is, you know, you're going to shift your attention to something pleasant or neutral, away from the real, or away from the imagined threat. If it's a real threat, then that you're not working on deactivation, you're working on activation, which is appropriate. So then, in a sense, at least, letting go is only appropriate when there's not an active threat present. Right? If you're being attacked, the right thing is to fight or flee. not to let go. But when you get home or you're back in your circle, you know, and you do all the things, you shake, you cry, you tell the story over and over, and you deactivate, what you're doing is letting go of activation. And we might say that healing from trauma is the same as like having fully let it go. Which doesn't mean forgetting. It really just means the charge is not present in the system causing distress. So I think really the basis that I'm talking about in terms of like, you know, the socioeconomic status piece and the appropriateness of the letting go instruction is something like, for those under active threat or danger, which includes the systemic dangers, letting go preemptively actually reduces the ability to be in fight and flight in a way that's appropriate. And so then it would be more appropriate to engage fight and flight, you know, to get angry and protest and fight back, or make good boundaries, etc. And then once relative safety is restored, then the practice of letting go would kind of swing in as the right thing to do. So that's a bit on that. I'm not sure what we'll do next week, but on the 5th of March, I believe it is, the first Tuesday in March, we'll start a series that'll be probably 8 weeks or so. Going systematically through mindfulness practice in the form of a very traditional kind of sequence of reflections that's been put together by this beautiful teacher, Venerable Anallio. And this works through reflections on the nature of the body, the nature of the elements, the death contemplations, the contemplations on feelings or affect and mind states, hindrances and enlightenment factors. And it's a beautiful sequence of practice. So we'll investigate each one of those seven kind of archetypal or important realms of mindfulness practice over the course of the 2 months, and then do a little tidying up at the end. So we'll sequence on Satipatthana practice in March and April. For that, all the talks on the website, and thank you for your generosity in supporting the group. They're asking in general that we give, that you give to support the group on your way in rather than after, which was our old method. So thanks for doing that.